From IntelliJix, this is IntelliJix World Religions, an educational look at the world's religions. This show neither endorses nor rejects any belief. By the time this episode ends, you will have a clearer sense of how Islam began, or at least how scholars piece together the evidence for that beginning. What its more than 1.8 billion adherents believe and practice, how this tradition has diversified into rich and sometimes fiercely debated streams, and how the academic study of Islam approaches a faith that is. Today we are stepping into a tradition that stretches from the volcanic highlands of 7th century Arabia to the skylines of Istanbul and Kuala Lumpur, from the philosophical academies of medieval Baghdad to the Friday prayers held in converted warehouses in Sheffield and Sao Paulo. Simultaneously ancient and urgently contemporary, this is Submission, Mercy, and the Straight Path, an introduction to Islam. Let's begin where most accounts of Islam begin, on the Arabian Peninsula in the late 6th century of the Common Era. The region we are talking about was not a cultural backwater. Scholars of late antiquity, historians like Robert Hoyland and Garth Fowden, have worked hard in recent decades to correct the old image of pre-Islamic Arabia as an isolated desert of warring tribes untouched by civilization. In fact, the peninsula sat at the crossroads of enormous trading networks. Caravans carried frankincense, spices, and silk between the Roman and Sasanian Persian empires. The city of Mecca, where our story centers, was a prosperous merchant hub and the site of a sanctuary called the Kaaba, a cube-shaped structure housing numerous idols that drew pilgrims and traders from across the region. Mecca's dominant tribe, the Quraysh, managed this sanctuary and the commerce that surrounded it. Into this world, into a family of the Quraysh, a child was born around 570 CE. His name was Muhammad ibn Abdallah. Here we should pause and say something about sources, because this matters enormously. These include the Quran itself, which Muslims regard as the direct word of God and which contains relatively little narrative biography. The Hadith, which are recorded sayings and reported actions of the Prophet. And the Sirah, meaning biographical literature, the most famous of which was compiled by Ibn Ishaq in the 8th century and survives in a later recension by Ibn. What we know, or more precisely, what we think we know, about Muhammad's life comes from a tradition of texts assembled mostly 1 to 2 centuries after his death. Hisham. Western scholars like Patricia Crone and Michael Cook caused significant controversy in the 1970s by arguing that these sources, written so long after the events they describe, cannot be taken as straightforward historical records. More recently, scholars like Gregor Scholar and Harold Motzke have pushed back, arguing that careful analysis of the chains of transmission, the isnad, as they are called, can help us recover earlier and more reliable layers. This debate is ongoing and genuinely unresolved. What we can say is that the portrait of Muhammad that emerges from the Islamic tradition itself is internally rich and remarkably consistent in its broad outlines, even if individual details are contested. According to that tradition, Muhammad was orphaned young. His father died before or shortly after his birth, and his mother Amina died when he was around 6 years old. He was raised by his grandfather and then by his uncle Abu Talib. He worked as a merchant and acquired a reputation for honesty so sterling that he earned the epithet Al-Amin, the trustworthy. At around the age of 25, he married a successful businesswoman named Khadija, who was older than him who had employed him, and who would become, by the tradition's own account, one of the most important people in his life. They had several children together, though most of Muhammad's sons died in infancy. Then, around the year 610 CE, when Muhammad was approximately 40 years old, something happened that would change the course of human history. Muhammad had developed a habit of retreating to a cave called Hira on a mountain outside Mecca for meditation and reflection, a practice that resonates with the broader tradition of spiritual retreat known across many cultures. During one of these retreats, the tradition holds, he was visited by the angel Jibril Gabriel in the Hebrew and Christian traditions, who commanded him to recite. Muhammad, who was not known to be literate, was terrified. He rushed home to Khadija trembling. She comforted him, and crucially, she believed him. She is recognized by Muslims as the first person to accept Islam. Her cousin Waraka ibn Nawfal, a Christian scholar, reportedly told her that Muhammad had received the same messenger who had come to Moses. This small detail is one of many that points to the deeply interconnected religious environment in which Islam emerged. Over the following 22 or so years, until his death in 632 CE, Muhammad continued to receive what he and his followers understood to be divine revelation. The early Meccan period was defined by relatively intimate community, intense preaching about the oneness of God and the coming judgment, and fierce resistance from Mecca's elites who saw Muhammad's message as a threat to their religious, social, and economic order. The persecution of early Muslims became severe enough that in 615, a group of them fled to the Christian kingdom of Aksum in Ethiopia, whose king granted them protection, an episode Muslims often cite as significant. Then in 622 came the event that marks the beginning of the Islamic calendar, the Hijra, the migration of Muhammad and his followers to the city of Yathrib, which would come to be called Medina, meaning the city. This migration was not merely geographic. It was the founding of a community, an ummah, a word that means something like nation or community of believers, and it inaugurated what scholars and Muslims alike regard as a new phase of the tradition, more political, more juridical, more comprehensive in its social vision. The Medinan revelations tend to deal more explicitly with law, governance, family life, and the structure of the community. The years that followed involved military conflict, treaties, betrayals by some parties, and diplomatic maneuvering. In 630, Muhammad led a largely peaceful conquest of Mecca. He reportedly entered the city, cleared the idols from the Kaaba, and declared a general amnesty. By the time of his death in 632, most of the Arabian Peninsula had, through combination of persuasion, political alliance, and military victory, come under the umbrella of this new religious and political community. Muhammad died in Medina, in the arms, the tradition says, of his wife Aisha, a woman who would go on to play a formative role in the transmission of Islamic knowledge, and who remains one of the most debated and revered figures in Islamic history. Now let us turn from history to theology, because, for the vast majority of Muslims, the historical narrative and the theological conviction are inseparable. You cannot understand Islam without understanding Tawhid. Tawhid is usually translated as the oneness of God, but that translation barely scratches the surface. Adherents describe it as the absolute, uncompromising, non-negotiable unity and uniqueness of the divine. There is one God, Allah in Arabic. Simply the definite article al combined with the word for God, illah, and Muslims are careful to note that Allah is not a different God from the God of Abraham, Moses, and Jesus, but the same God referred to by Arabic-speaking Christians and Jews as well. This God has no partners, no children in a literal sense, no equals. God is utterly beyond comparison. The Quran states this with characteristic concision in what Muslims regard as one of its most essential passages, the 112th surah called Al-Ikhlas. Say, He is God, the One, God, the Eternal Refuge. He neither begot nor was begotten, and there is none comparable to Him. That surah is 4 verses long, and some scholars of Islamic thought have said it contains the theological core of the entire religion. The opposite of Tawhid, the great sin in Islamic theology, is shirk, which means associating partners with God, treating something finite as if it were divine or worthy of the worship due only to God. Classical Islamic theology is deeply concerned with avoiding anything that might shade into idolatry, and this concern shapes everything from the abstract heights of philosophical theology down to the textures of daily life. Muslims believe that God has communicated with humanity throughout history through a series of prophets and messengers. The tradition lists many of them: Adam, Noah, Abraham, Ishmael, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, David, Solomon, John the Baptist, and Jesus among them. All of these figures are, in Islamic understanding, Muslims in the root sense of that word, people who submitted to God. Islam, the noun, and Muslim, the participle, both come from the Arabic root SLM, which carries meanings of submission, peace, and wholeness. To be a Muslim is to be one who submits to God. The tradition holds that previous revelations, the Torah given to Moses, the Psalms to David, the Gospel to Jesus, were genuine divine communications, but that over time these texts became corrupted or misunderstood, which necessitated a final, complete, and perfectly preserved revelation. The Quran, given to Muhammad as the seal of the prophets, the last in the line. This brings us to the Quran itself, and it is almost impossible to overstate its centrality to Islam. The word Quran comes from a root meaning to recite or to read aloud, and that oral, sonic dimension is essential. For Muslims, the Quran is not simply a book about God's word. It is God's word, the actual speech of God, uncreated and eternal, transmitted in Arabic through the angel Jibril to Muhammad, who then conveyed it to his community. Muslims memorize it, chant it, write it in elaborate calligraphy, hold physical copies with ritual care, and orient their prayers toward its language. A person who has memorized the entire Quran, all 114 surahs, approximately 77,000 words, is given the honorific title of Hafiz, meaning one who preserves, and this is considered a significant spiritual and intellectual achievement. The Quran is organized not chronologically but roughly by length, with the longer surahs generally earlier in the book and the shorter ones toward the end, a structure that is more or less the inverse of the chronological order of revelation. This can make reading it sequentially, especially for newcomers, feel somewhat non-linear. Some examine its relationship to the broader religious milieu of late antique Arabia, noting resonances with Jewish and Christian texts and traditions. Figures like Fred Donner and Angelica Newworth have done important work here, with Newworth in particular arguing that the Quran is best understood as engaging in a kind of intertextual dialogue with the scriptural traditions. The themes range from the grandeur and mercy of God to legal regulations about marriage, inheritance, and commerce, from vivid descriptions of paradise and hell to narratives about previous prophets, from intimate consolation to urgent moral exhortation. Scholars outside the Islamic tradition study the Quran with a range of methods. Of late antiquity, others apply text-critical methods similar to those used on the Hebrew Bible or New Testament. From within the tradition, Muslim scholars have developed elaborate sciences of Quranic interpretation, tafsir, that constitute one of the great intellectual traditions of human civilization. Alongside the Quran, the Hadith literature plays an essential role. These are the recorded sayings and actions of the Prophet, transmitted through chains of narrators, and subjected to rigorous critique by classical Muslim scholars who developed sophisticated methods for evaluating their authenticity. The most trusted collections, those of Bukhari and Muslim, compiled in the 9th century, are sometimes called the Sahihain, meaning the two authentic ones. Together, the Quran and the authenticated Hadith form the primary sources of the Sharia, the Arabic term for the comprehensive divine law and ethical framework that guides Muslim life, and which comes from a root meaning something like a path leading to water, a beautiful image of guidance toward life-sustaining truth. So what does a Muslim actually do? This is where the five pillars come in, and though the pillar metaphor is a later formulation rather than a Quranic one, it captures something structurally true about Islamic practice. These are the Shahada, Salat, Zakat, Psalm, and Hajj. The Shahada is the declaration of faith. Ashhadu an la ilaha illa Allah, wa ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasul Allah, I bear witness that there is no God but God, and I bear witness that Muhammad is the messenger of God. This is the utterance that, spoken with sincere intention before witnesses, makes a person a Muslim. It frames the call to prayer. It is the first thing whispered into a newborn's ear in many Muslim traditions and the last words spoken at the bedside of the dying. It is simultaneously the simplest and most theologically loaded statement imaginable. Salat is the formal ritual prayer performed 5 times a day, at dawn, midday, mid-afternoon, sunset, and night. Before prayer, a Muslim performs wudu ritual purification through washing specific parts of the body with water. The prayer itself is remarkably choreographed. Specific words, specific postures, standing, bowing, prostrating, sitting, in a fixed sequence. It is performed facing the Qibla, the direction of the Kaaba in Mecca. The 5 daily prayers are a kind of rhythmic structuring of time, a daily reminder of the divine presence that cuts across whatever else one is doing. The communal Friday midday prayer, Juma, carries special importance. It includes a sermon called the Khutba, and Muslims are generally expected to attend in congregation if they are able. Zakat is obligatory almsgiving, a specific portion of one's accumulated wealth, classically calculated as 2.5% of savings held above a minimum threshold for a full lunar year, given annually to specific categories of recipients defined in the Quran. It is not charity in the voluntary sense. It is a financial obligation, a recognition that wealth ultimately belongs to God, that society has claims on individual surplus, that economic justice is a religious requirement. Many Muslims also give sadaqah, voluntary charity, above and beyond zakat, and the Islamic tradition places extraordinary emphasis on generosity. Psalm is the fast of Ramadan, the 9th month of the Islamic lunar calendar, the month in which, the tradition holds, the Quran began to be revealed. From the pre-dawn meal called suhoor to the breaking of the fast at sunset with iftar, Muslims who are physically able abstain from all food, drink, and sexual relations during the daylight hours. But Ramadan is more than abstinence. It is a month of intensified prayer, Quran recitation, community gathering, and spiritual reflection. The evenings during Ramadan have a particular character in Muslim communities around the world. The iftar meal shared with family and neighbors, the night prayers called Taraweeh performed in the mosques, the night of power, Laylat al-Qadr, occurring in the last 10 days of Ramadan, is considered the holiest night of the year, the night on which the first revelation descended. Hajj is the pilgrimage to Mecca, obligatory once in a lifetime for every Muslim who is physically and financially able. Every year, in the 12th month of the Islamic calendar, millions of Muslims, historically the largest annual peaceful gathering of human beings on earth, converge on the holy sites around Mecca. They enter a state of ritual purity and simplicity called ihram, wearing identical white garments that erase social distinctions of wealth and status. They circumambulate the Kaaba 7 times, walk between the hills of Safa and Marwa in memory of Hagar, searching for water for her infant son Ismail, stand together in prayer on the plain of Arafat in the most spiritually climactic moment of the pilgrimage, throw pebbles at pillars symbolizing Satan, and sacrifice an animal whose meat is distributed to the poor. The experience of Hajj, by the consistent testimony of those who have undertaken it, is among the most profound of human experiences. A convergence of the personal, the communal, the historical, and the transcendent. The great American civil rights leader Malcolm X wrote in his autobiography about how performing Hajj in 1964 transformed his understanding of race and human solidarity. His experience standing among Muslims of every ethnicity and nation is often cited as one of the most vivid testimonies to what Hajj can mean. Islamic practice does not stop with the 5 pillars, of course. Life cycle rituals, the Akikah sacrifice at the birth of a child, circumcision, the Islamic wedding contract called Nikah, the rituals surrounding death and burial, give religious shape to the major passages of human life. Islamic law has historically governed everything from personal hygiene to commercial contracts, from criminal justice to dietary regulations. Muslims who observe halal, permissible dietary laws abstain from pork, alcohol, and animals not slaughtered in the prescribed way. Prayer spaces, from the grandest mosques to the corner of a bedroom with a prayer rug, are sites of daily encounter with the divine. Now, we have been speaking as though there is one Islam, and of course there is, in the sense that Muslims overwhelmingly affirm the same core commitments we have described. But the diversity of Islamic practice and theology across 1.8 billion people, spread across every continent, speaking hundreds of languages, inhabiting every conceivable cultural context, is enormous. Let us spend some time with the major divisions and streams of this tradition. The most significant and oldest division in Islam is between Sunni and Shia Muslims, and it is impossible to understand it without returning to the immediate aftermath of Muhammad's death. When the Prophet died in 632, without leaving explicit written instructions about his successor, a crisis of leadership emerged. The majority of the community supported Abu Bakr, one of Muhammad's closest companions and father-in-law, as the first caliph, the political and religious leader of the community. He was followed by Umar, then Uthman, and then Ali ibn Abi Talib, Muhammad's cousin and son-in-law, husband of his daughter Fatima. Those who became Sunni Muslims accepted this sequence, and the principle that leadership should be determined by communal consensus among qualified companions. Those who became Shia Muslims, Shayat Ali, the partisans of Ali, held that leadership rightfully belonged to Ali from the beginning, that Muhammad had designated him at an event called Ghadir Khum, and that leadership should flow through the line of Ali and Fatima and their descendants, known as Imams with a capital I, who possess special spiritual authority. The tragedy that definitively shaped Shia identity occurred in 680 CE at Karbala in present-day Iraq. Ali's son Husayn, the grandson of the Prophet, led a small group of followers against the forces of the Umayyad Caliph Yazid. Husayn and most of his male companions were killed on the plain of Karbala on the 10th of Muharram, a day called Ashura. For Shia Muslims, Karbala is not merely a historical event but a foundational spiritual reality, a paradigm of justice standing against tyranny, of sacrifice and suffering, whose meaning is renewed through ritual mourning, processions, passion plays called taziyah in some traditions, and the pilgrimage to Husayn's shrine in Karbala itself. The raw grief expressed in Shia Ashura observances can be startling to outside observers. But scholars like David Pinault and Lara Deeb have helped document how these rituals serve profound communal and psychological functions. Sunni Muslims today constitute approximately 85-90% of the world's Muslim population. Within Sunni Islam, there are four major classical schools of legal thought, the Hanafi, Maliki, Shafi'i, and Hanbali madhabs, named after their founding scholars. These schools do not disagree about fundamental doctrine, but do differ on many points of legal interpretation and methodology. The diversity within Sunni practice is enormous. The Islam of a Malian village where local practice blends with Sufi influences looks very different from the Islam of a Saudi Salafi context, yet both would identify as Sunni. Shia Islam itself has multiple branches. The largest is Twelver Shia, prevalent in Iran, Iraq, Bahrain, and Lebanon, and significant minorities elsewhere. Twelver Shia believe in a line of 12 imams, the last of whom, Muhammad al-Mahdi, went into occultation in the 9th century and is believed to be alive and will return at the end of times. The Ismaili branch, sometimes called Sevener Shia, follows a different line of succession and today is led by the Aga Khan, a figure who holds both religious authority and significant influence in development and education work globally. The Zaydi branch, predominant in Yemen, holds somewhat different views on the imamate and in some respects is closer to Sunni practice. Then there is Sufism, which deserves its own careful consideration. Sufism, known in Arabic as tasawuf, is the mystical dimension of Islam, the tradition oriented toward direct, intimate experience of God, the cultivation of the inner life, and the purification of the heart. The word Sufi may derive from the Arabic word for wool, suf, referring to the rough woolen garments worn by early Muslim ascetics who turned away from worldly comfort. From roughly the 8th and 9th centuries, a rich tradition of Sufi spirituality developed, producing some of the greatest poets and thinkers in the history of the Islamic world, and arguably in the history of human spirituality. The 13th century Persian poet Jalal al-Din Rumi, known in the West simply as Rumi, was a Sufi mystic whose Masnavi and Divani Shams are among the most widely read works of poetry in human history. His images of the reed flute crying for its origin, of the moth drawn to the flame of divine love, of the lover and the beloved, have resonated across centuries and cultures. The Mevlevi order founded in his memory is known for the Sema ceremony, the whirling meditation that has become one of the most recognizable images of Islamic spiritual practice. Another towering figure is Ibn Arabi, the 12th and 13th century Andalusian mystic, whose concept of Wahdat al-Wujud, the unity of being, has been among the most philosophically influential and most theologically contested ideas in Islamic intellectual history. These orders, the Qadiriyya, Naqshbandiyya, Tijaniyya, Shadhiliyya, and many others, have historically been among the most important vehicles for the spread of Islam, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, Central Asia, South Asia, and Southeast Asia, where Sufi missionaries and saints brought the faith through commerce, teaching, and the sheer compelling power of their. Sufis organized themselves into orders called tariqa, meaning path, each with its own chain of spiritual transmission linking masters to disciples back through history, ideally to the Prophet himself. Spiritual example. The veneration of Sufi saints and the pilgrimage to their shrines remains a widespread and beloved practice across much of the Muslim world, even as it is criticized by more scripturally literalist movements as potentially dangerous border territory with shirk. This brings us to the internal debates and contemporary tensions that animate Islam today, and they are real and significant. One of the defining tensions of modern Islam is between what scholars often call reform or revivalist movements on one hand, and more traditional or Sufi-inflected practices on the other. The Wahhabi movement, founded in 18th century Arabia by Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab in alliance with the political house of Saud, called for a return to what it understood as pristine early Islam, stripping away later accretions including much of the saint veneration and elaborate ritual that had developed in Sufi and popular practice. This movement gained extraordinary global influence in the 20th century, partly through the oil wealth of Saudi Arabia, which funded mosques, schools, and publications around the world. The Diabandi movement in South Asia, the Salafi movements in various forms, these represent a broader reformist impulse that has been theologically serious and internally diverse, even as its most extreme political expressions, movements that most Muslims categorically reject, have generated enormous controversy and suffering. But it would be deeply misleading to suggest that this reformist impulse represents the majority or even the dominant Islam of today's world. The Islam of rural Morocco, with its devotion to local saints and its Maliki legal tradition, is genuinely different in texture from the Islam of Java, which has absorbed elements of local cosmology and Hindu-Buddhist aesthetics into a distinctive Indonesian Muslim identity, which is itself different from the Islam of Dakar, where the Murid Sufi order founded by Amadou Bamba. The Islam lived by the overwhelming majority of the world's Muslims is deeply embedded in local cultural contexts, shaped by centuries of legal scholarship, poetic tradition, popular devotion, and family practice that looks very different from any idealized model, has created a distinctly Senegalese form of spiritual community. This diversity is not, most Muslim scholars would insist, a fragmentation. It is the natural expression of a universal faith in diverse human soils. Contemporary Islam also grapples with questions that face all the world's great traditions in modernity. How do the classical legal texts, formed in very different historical circumstances, speak to contemporary questions about democracy, human rights, gender equality, bioethics, environmentalism, and interfaith relations? Muslim thinkers occupy an enormous spectrum of positions on these questions. Reformist and progressive Muslim scholars, figures like Amin Awadud, Khald Abu el-Fadl, and Tariq Ramadan, though that last name has become deeply controversial for personal reasons, have argued for reading Islamic sources in ways that affirm gender equality, religious pluralism, and democratic governance. More conservative scholars, drawing on classical legal tradition, offer different readings. And everything in between exists too, in the vast and ongoing conversation that is Islamic jurisprudence and theology today. Questions about women's roles are particularly charged. On one hand, Islamic history includes women scholars, business leaders, and political figures going back to the Prophet's own wives. Aisha is credited with transmitting enormous amounts of hadith and correcting the companions of the Prophet on points of religious practice. The tradition of women as scholars, though often marginalized, has never entirely disappeared, and scholars like Akram Nadwi have documented hundreds of women hadith scholars across Islamic history. On the other hand, many contemporary Muslim societies have implemented legal structures and social norms that severely restrict women's mobility, education, and rights. Structures that reform-minded Muslims argue are cultural impositions rather than Islamic requirements. The question of the hijab, the headscarf, and more extensive coverings like the niqab or burqa sits at the intersection of theology, politics, personal conscience, feminist theory, and secular liberalism in ways that cannot be reduced to simple answers. Some Muslim women experience covering as a profound act of faith and liberation. Others experience requirements to cover as oppressive. The academic literature on this is rich and contested. The relationship between Islam and political governance is another enormous area. The 20th century saw the rise of various forms of political Islam. Islamism, the project of grounding modern state governance in Islamic principles. This project ranges from democratic parties that participate peacefully in electoral politics, like Tunisia's Ennahda movement, to theocratic experiments like the Islamic Republic of Iran, to violent revolutionary movements that most Muslims regard as outside the bounds of their faith. The history of Muslim-Christian-Jewish relations includes centuries of coexistence and cross-pollination. The intellectual golden age of Islamic civilization in Baghdad and Cordoba transmitted ancient Greek philosophy back to a Europe that had largely lost it. Jewish and Christian scholars flourished under Muslim rulers in ways that were genuinely pluralistic by the standards. The question of whether Islam requires a specific form of political organization, or whether it is compatible with multiple forms of governance, is vigorously debated by Muslim scholars and political theorists. And then there are the questions of Islam's relationship with the non-Muslim world, which are freighted with enormous historical and contemporary weight. Of any medieval context, even as dhimmi, protected minority, status, was a form of second-class citizenship. It also includes the Crusades, colonial conquest by Christian European powers, the complex and painful history of the Middle East in the 20th century, and the post-September 2001 context in which Muslims globally have navigated heightened suspicion and discrimination. The diversity of Muslim experience and Muslim responses to this context is as enormous as the Muslim community itself. How do scholars study all of this? The academic study of Islam, housed in departments of religious studies, Islamic studies, history, anthropology, political science, and literature, has evolved significantly. It moved from a largely philological enterprise in the 19th century editing and translating texts, through an Orientalist period whose blind spots and Eurocentric assumptions have been analyzed and critiqued extensively following Edward Said's influential work, toward more self-aware and methodologically diverse approaches today. Scholars use historical critical methods to examine sources, social scientific methods to study contemporary Muslim communities, phenomenological approaches to understand religious experience from the inside, and comparative methods to situate Islam within the broader landscape of human religious life. One particularly rich area of contemporary scholarship examines how Islam is lived in practice. Not just what texts say, but what people actually do. How ordinary Muslims in specific communities navigate faith, modernity, tradition, and change. Anthropologists like Saba Mahmoud, whose work on piety movements in Egypt challenge certain feminist assumptions about agency and resistance, have opened up new ways of understanding religious practice. Sociologists of religion study Muslim communities in diaspora in Europe, North America, Australia, grappling with questions of identity, belonging, and the negotiation of tradition in new contexts. Legal scholars study the evolution of Islamic law and its interactions with modern state legal systems. What emerges from all of this study is a portrait of Islam as one of the most complex, generative, and varied of human religious traditions. A tradition with a single, crystalline theological center in the affirmation of God's oneness, radiating outward into extraordinary diversity of expression. A tradition that produced, in its classical period, some of the greatest mathematics, astronomy, medicine, philosophy, architecture, and poetry in human history. A tradition that offers its adherents a total way of life, a comprehensive framework for understanding existence, a community of belonging that spans the globe, and a relationship with the divine characterized by both awe and intimacy. The name Islam itself contains a paradox worth sitting with at the end of our journey today. When the Quran says in Surah Al-Baqarah that God is closer to a person than their jugular vein, that image of absolute divine intimacy, it is gesturing at something that the tradition returns to again and again. That the God to whom one submits is not a distant tyrant but the very ground of one's being, the source of mercy and compassion, who opens the Quran with the words, submission, Islam, might sound to modern ears like the abandonment of freedom, the crushing of the self, but adherents consistently describe it differently. They describe the submission of the self to God not as self-abnegation, but as the deepest possible realization of what the self truly is. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim, in the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful. Those two divine attributes, Rahman and Rahim, both from the Arabic root for mercy and womb, begin every chapter of the Quran except one. Mercy is not incidental to Islam's self-understanding. In the tradition's own telling, it is the ocean in which the straight path runs. There is so much more to say. We have not had time to explore Islamic art and architecture, the breathtaking geometric complexity of the Alhambra, the soaring minarets of Istanbul, the manuscript traditions of Persia and Morocco. We have barely touched on Islamic philosophy, the brilliant arguments of Al-Kindi, Al-Farabi, Ibn Sina, Al-Ghazali, Ibn Rushd, a tradition that engaged Aristotle, Plato, Neoplatonism, and generated entirely new syntheses. What we hope you are taking away today is a foundation, an understanding of how a faith tradition crystallized in 7th century Arabia around a series of revelations received by a merchant named Muhammad, how that tradition articulated a radical, uncompromising theology of divine oneness, how it shaped daily life through 5 foundational practices, how it canonized a sacred text that its adherents regard as God's direct speech, how it diversified into Sunni, Shia, and Sufi streams while maintaining a recognizable core, how it built civilizations and continues to shape the lives of nearly a quarter of the human beings alive on Earth today, and how scholars, both inside and outside the tradition, are still working to understand its texts. We have only gestured at the immense diversity of Islam in sub-Saharan Africa, in South and Southeast Asia, in the contemporary Muslim diaspora communities of the West. These are territories for future episodes, history, and its living communities. This has been Intellijix World Religions. We are grateful you joined us on this particular stretch of the straight path, exploring, with curiosity and respect, the extraordinary diversity of human religious experience. Until next time.